This is CHUO 89.1 FM. Welcome to this week's episode of The Mosaic, your weekly show highlighting the voices of the community. Here, we guide you through today's social issues, introduce you to changemakers, and keep in touch with the arts, music, and events of the city. You can expect extensive research, in-depth analysis, and discussion. From CHUO's news team, this is The Mosaic. Today, a panel from the Ottawa Black Film Festival. CHUO's Marcela Gonzalez brings us notes from the event. And a chart-topping Nigerian-American singer, Rotimi, performs in Ottawa this weekend. A film review of Spotlight, a true story filled with observations on journalism, the church, and a harrowing scandal. And after 107 years, we look back on the Battle of Vimy Ridge. Stick around, I'm Lauren Rolston, and we've got all that and more coming up on The Mosaic.
The Ottawa Black Film Festival hosted a black market full of discussions with STEAM panelists. Last month, I had the opportunity to attend one of them with my colleague Faith Atijani. These discussions were a part of a series of panels the festival put together, assembling industry experts, artists, and like-minded individuals to cover the most pressing topics and concerns of filmmaking. There were talks about black women in media, tips on becoming a podcast writer, the role of AI in the industry, and the panel we went to, called Securing a Space for Black Creatives in Ottawa's Thriving Film Industry. It was moderated by poet, comedian, and screenwriter LaDana Lee. She asked insightful questions on the theme of black inclusivity in the film industry, which blossomed into a group discussion of personal experiences and advice for the art community in Ottawa. In that hour and a half, we heard the words of Alain André, Iyore Dekpe, Simba Yakibonge, and Azaseria Toe. This group, composed of a multidisciplinary artist, a film producer, two actors and models, came together to display their knowledge and hopes for the industry. I heard many things I found interesting, that moved me, and that have stayed with me. One of them was when Nigerian film producer Iyore Dekpe spoke about her short film Cat Got Your Tongue, which is showcased in the Being Black in Canada 2022 series, a program dedicated to mentoring and giving a voice to black filmmakers in cinema and television.
I was born and raised in Nigeria, so I have a Nigerian accent, which I'm very proud of. And this project, I made it because I was part of the BBIC core group from last year. And I had an opportunity to talk about something that was very, like, you know, important to me. And I really cracked my brain about it. And I was like, one thing that's important to me that really shaped my identity is my accent. And how my accent has been viewed over the years, especially over the years being in Canada, which is a foreign land for me at that point. So just to give you a quick background about the film itself, it is broken into several parts, starting with my journey as a black woman in Canada, dealing with a foreign accent when I first moved to Canada. And I kind of just touched on that, talking about like how I assumed coming to Canada, there would be no issues with how I sound. But as the years went by, I had several issues, I would say, with how people sort of like viewed me and how I sounded.
She mentioned how the story evolved into a discussion of the standard American accent in the acting industry, and how this has affected the way she views her work.
And I found that when I first started acting in this country, there was this particular requirement that if you don't have the standard American accent, you're not necessarily considered any longer roles. And that made me feel a type of way. I was like, no. If that's how it is, then I just have to create my own works and, you know, represent my own accent, which I think is very beautiful.
Later, through Yuri's experiences and those of her Nigerian friends, the film dives into the phenomenon of code switching, which, according to Encyclopedia Britannica, is a process of shifting from one linguistic code to another, depending on the social context or controversial setting. Harvard Business Review gives example of black students alternating between using a standard English when they're in the classroom versus using the African-American vernacular English when they're among friends. Or take the film Everything Everywhere All at Once, where the dance between Chinese and English gives clues to the audience about the underlying meaning behind some of the dialogues. Although code switching is most often associated with bilingual communities, it can also be done within one language. People can shift the style they use depending on who they're speaking with, or tone down their accent in order to blend into the more dominant culture. The reasons for code switching are multiple and are based on context alone. But some include wanting to receive a fair treatment, like obtaining equal employment opportunities, or to gain acceptance. Luckily, we were also able to get a year's personal definition and experience with code switching after the panel ended.
Code switching is kind of, it's broad. I don't know if there's one definite answer or one definite definition for that. But the way I see code switching is you trying to conform from outside of yourself within, like, because of the people around you. So to give you a very brief example, it would be, I would normally speak differently when I'm amongst other Nigerians. My accent is more pronounced when I'm with other Nigerians. I'm allowed to just, you know, kind of delve back to my my upbringing and everything else. But when I'm like with non-Nigerians, non-speaking Nigerians, I kind of like go, I kind of retreat into like speaking more like a Canadian because I kind of want to fit in amongst the other people. When I was doing the documentary, I noticed that code switching is kind of like a mental thing. So sometimes you don't even know when you do it. You subconsciously do it, right? You just subconsciously just switch because you want to make others around you comfortable. And you also want to fit in. So that is how I would define code switching, especially from my personal perspective. But it's very interesting. I feel like I still have a lot of like reading to do about what code switching is because I feel like it's bigger than what I think it is, right? So for now, I just see it based on my experience, my personal experience, but I think it's still a lot bigger than that. A lot of people code switch regardless of their accent. They code switch in different ways, right? You can code switch with like how you carry yourself, how you dress, just because you want to fit in with your peers. But yeah, that's kind of how particularly code switching, that's how I see it.
As she said, code switching doesn't only have to do with the words we use. As time has passed, the term has grown to also include changes in behavior and appearance. All of the speakers had different things to say. But one thing they agreed on was the ridiculous idea of leaving Ottawa to become an artist.
If you want to succeed as an artist in this country, leave Ottawa, leave Ottawa. Whenever I hear that, I just have this fury inside me. Like, what do you mean leave Ottawa? Like, Ottawa is great. We just need more artists here in Ottawa proud of themselves and their art and just continue showcasing that. That's what we need. Don't tell people leave Ottawa, leave Ottawa. Leave Ottawa and go where? Go to an oversaturated place like Montreal and Toronto where you have to even compete more. Ottawa has the space, Ottawa has the people. We just need to give them a chance. That's what I always tell everybody whenever I hear that.
However, they did consider what the Ottawa Black art scene currently needs to grow stronger, with an identity that can stand on its own.
My question is, how can we create our own Black artistic renaissance here in Ottawa? You know, Montreal, Toronto, and even, I don't think Vancouver, though not so much, has a strong Black art scene. How do we make Ottawa the new Montreal circa the 60s? And is that possible?
The sure answer was continued funding and support.
So the thing with funding is, I think, the funding is there, but for a lot of us, it's hard to understand the landscape of it. Just how to navigate access to that funding. For me, it's been a problem for this year, you know, just trying to understand how to even apply for grants, how to even pitch shows to networks, or how to even, so I think at the Toronto Black Film Festival, they had a panel where people would actually come in and teach you how to apply for grants, how to, you know, pitch to networks. I think it's stuff like that we need to even understand how to navigate what is being offered to us, I think.
Otaseri focused on a more crucial thing that had never crossed my mind, the places creators film their movies in.
I want to speak more on locations and like finding areas to film in. One thing I'm starting to look at now is like permits and where I'm allowed to film. Right now, all the places I have in my mind are like from friends and like people I have relationships with. So relationships are key. Schools, houses, all that. But yeah, I feel like if they have a platform or just open their doors and say, you know, you can film here. And we're not so scared to ask and think like we're immediately gonna get shut down. So yeah.
As for the support, it has to come not only from the government, but also from the community into the community itself.
So just to sum it up, it's like, it's all about creating relationships, but also just empowering yourselves and having the belief that we can do it. And slowly gathering more evidence for it. So, and bridging the gaps with larger institutions, but also knowing that like we need to do it for ourselves and understand that they probably need us more than we need them in a way, because they need our identity, they need our the flavor or the perspective that we have. The audience is looking for that, and there's a lack of it, you know? There's a community of people that want to see black films. There's a community of people that want to see black art, right?
Tied to this is also the need for more mentorship. Ladan pointed to this when she pulled out the statistics of black young people in the Ottawa-Gatineau region. The National Capital Region has the third largest black population, being the home of more than 100,000 people, according to Statistics Canada's 2021 census. What's more, about 25% of this number is under 15 years old, making it so the black population is the youngest visible minority group in Canada, as is stated in the Statistics Canada data released for last year's Black History Month. With this reality in mind, Ladan wonders what can be done to ensure more black youth are exposed to the arts.
It starts at home. I also grew up in a Nigerian household, so it's like, growing up, I want to do dance. And they're like, dance doesn't make money. Like, go to school, get a degree, and work. I got my degree. I don't got no work. And I'm just looking at it like, if our parents can foster us and tell us, you know what, you can be what you want to be, whether that's a creative artist, singer, dancer, actor, producer, director, then they'll go out of their way and they'll put their child into it. Like, there's so many sports programs and music programs, but where's the arts? And I feel like, yeah, if we had more mentorship, I feel like mentorship starts at the agency, there's studios, but it's like the network. Networking is where I feed off. Like, just listening to you guys, I'm like, yes, I can like see myself growing with you guys, because it's motivating. Like, if you don't have anybody to look up to, you're like, I'm alone in this. What's the point of continuing? And like you said, like, people will give out within the year. And I didn't realize that until I stepped in. Like, so many people just gave up. And I'm like, no, like,
stability is super important, especially in this industry. Like, just feeding off the energy of everyone else. Like, I didn't think I was gonna be a screenwriter. I went to one event in Ottawa, and then I'm just fascinated and like, oh, this is what I always wanted to do. Forget this government job. Sorry, no offense to government jobs. But like, it's like, we weren't inspired by our families, like you're saying, at all. And then it feels like sometimes, it feels like we're catching up. Like, you're trying to be great, but you're also catching up. Not to visual artists who just naturally know how to paint and draw, I'm sorry. But like, everything else, like, I feel like you're just catching up. And it's like, how do we prevent that? I guess just fostering a better next generation.
After Osiris and Aldan's answer, Alan talked about how this mentorship relationship is rewarding for established artists too.
Being able to teach what we have to a younger generation also helps us, reminds us like where we came from, but also gives you that sense of pride. Like, I remember one time I was teaching a group of students, and I was asking them like, who's their favorite artist? And one of them like blurted like, you're my favorite artist. In that moment, I was just like, yo, don't cry, but you know, just give me a second, you know? And then I had to like, collect myself and be like, wow. It kind of gave me a sense of genuine like pride in that moment, like, not in a bad way, but like, a lot of times you might have like a sense of imposter syndrome and whatnot, but you realize like, wow, like, people actually, you know, like, people are looking up to you. So having the older mentor keeps you humble. It helps you get to that next level where you don't feel like you're catching up or like you're falling behind.
They also talked about the challenges they see in the Ottawa art scene. Simba explained that most of them came from being one of the first generations of black artists that had the option to stay in the city, instead of migrating into other Canadian cities.
Now that we have the option to build here and, you know, expand here, we have to do it without the pre-existing infrastructure. which is, I think, the hard part for us, because we don't have, especially Black-led, you know, companies, we don't, they're just starting, everyone is just starting, so I think we have to see ourselves as the tip of the spear and really create, start from zero, each and every one of us, build like that.
LaDan also described the path ahead.
It's a lot of work, though. That's why I'm like, I wish there was a generation before. So we have to be the ones to create, you know, even though we might not see the flower, I'll be cheesy, but we have to still plant the seeds. And that's my mantra right now, is like, always remember, like, it's not going to be you. Think about all those who fought in, like, this ongoing civil war, civil activisty here now, but, like, think of all the work they did, like Malcolm X and Martin Luther King and all our African leaders to get us even here on panels, and Caribbean leaders, you know what I mean? So I went off track, though. So I'm saying we can do it. We can just, like, grind it out for a little bit.
But regardless of this task they were forced to take, I didn't hear anything but hope and encouragement to enrich Ottawa.
And I wanted to say, why not? Like, we can definitely get there. We gotta tell the world what we wanna see, because if you don't ask, you won't know. I think Ottawa is like the biggest for Christmas Hallmark movies. So why can't we do that with everything else? You know, when it comes to Toronto, yes, there's opportunities there, but we're here right now. And I feel like when we have the resources, like we're starting to do, and the communities and the opportunities to actually get together and pick each other's brains and actually know, like, oh, you want to do the story? Okay, let me help you. We don't have to think we're going through it alone and then, you know, it never gets done and our story never gets told. So yeah, we can definitely even surpass Toronto, surpass Montreal, surpass Vancouver. Like, instead of running away
heritage
to LA,
moment right here.
Like, instead of running away to LA, they'll be like, I want to come to Ottawa, where it snows. Like,
what I gathered was that with everyone's effort, Ottawa can turn into something beautiful, something that's alive, and that, in my opinion, is already being nourished by the energy of artists like Dadan, Iyore, Osesere, Alan, and Simba.
Like, you need to create a heartbeat for the city, and a city without a soul is dead, I think. So I just, like, I had a sister who just left and moved to Korea because she's like, it's just not enough. I need something. I need people to just be hanging out on the street and listening to music. You know, just more an artist life. And she found that Ottawa was lacking when she did leave. So I think why I'm passionate about creating that in Ottawa is we need more color. It's cold. It's a cold city. We need more art, we need more comedy, we need more music, we need more paintings, and we're gonna have a sad future if we don't continue to build that here. And I think it's important for what you guys are doing.
For CHUO, I'm Marcela Gonzalez.
And this weekend, coming up on Sunday, Ottawa's third edition of the Black Business Expo. Over 100 vendors from the Black community are coming together in a celebration of diversity, entrepreneurship, and culture. From 10 a.m. to 6 p.m. at the Shaw Center, visitors can see performers, singers, and dancers. There'll be a food zone to try out a variety of cultural cuisines, and thought-provoking panels to learn from successful Black business owners. Black-owned businesses face unique challenges. Statistics Canada reports that in 2018, there was an estimated 66,800 Black business owners in Canada. That accounts for 2.1% of all business owners at the time. Newer studies show that the number of Black-owned enterprises in Canada is on the rise. And this weekend's event aims to showcase the diversity and success of the Black business community in Ottawa. For more information and tickets to the expo, head to Eventbrite.
This Saturday, Nigerian-American actor and singer Rotimi will be performing at the Palace in the Byward Market. He'll be joined by Montreal artists Nate and Lil K HPB. Rotimi's music is a fusion of contemporary R&B, Afrobeats, and dancehall. He's been singing since he was 3, and by 8 years old, he'd already traveled around New Jersey as a Nigerian wedding singer. He's got over 2,500,000 monthly listeners on Spotify and has worked with Jay-Z, 50 Cent, and Jamie Foxx. Interestingly enough, he met Fox at a nightclub in 2012 and didn't even recognize the Oscar winner. Rotimi's music has been influenced by artists like Bob Marley and Miss Lauryn Hill, and he's released a mellow single this year called Sade. The lyrics of Sade are about overcoming fear and building trust in a new relationship. Myokun sings on the track about changing and repenting from his old ways, and Nasty C mentions fighting the stereotype of other men who failed to treat their significant others properly. Folks interested in attending the show on Saturday at 10 p.m. can head to Eventbrite, where tickets are $43. For CHUO, I am Cecile Tala.
And now we turn to CHUO's Bushra Benhamed for an in-depth film review.
The world's best-kept secret, relentless journalists, and the true, unsavory definition of community. Those are the elements of this week's review of Tom McCarthy's 2015 film, Spotlight. Based on the tremendous true story, the Best Picture-winning film followed the Spotlight team of the Boston Globe newspaper as they investigate a case that would rattle and shape the world permanently. Accusations of decades-long sexual abuse of children in the Catholic Church. The film is unremarkable visually, and it seems to have been a conscious choice made by the filmmakers. It's almost as if to tell the audience, hey, we're not here for a pretty picture. We're here for a story that you cannot be distracted from. The most notable visuals are grand, sprawling shots of Boston. However, a running theme of the film is that in many of the shots, the church is either present or it is towering over the characters, looming over them like an ever-present dark entity that is watching their every move threateningly closely. A special aspect of this film is that the character actors, those playing the survivors, give the best performances out of the bunch. They are incredibly profound and emotional, and they serve as the film's purpose and its beating heart. Spotlight sets out to demonstrate just how deep-rooted the evil of the Catholic Church is, but it also serves as a criticism for journalists. We see more times than one that the journalists in the film had been previously informed about the abuses taking place in Boston, having been sent names and evidence in previous years. However, due to lack of interest or perhaps seeing that the stories were too thin or unimportant, they were buried in random columns or not spoken about altogether. The film goes on to highlight the importance of community for both the benefit and the demise of its people. Because as it states over and over that the Bostonian people all love their city, it implies that they love it to a fault. That they are willing to overlook or worse, cover up such egregious acts in the name of maintaining community and in the name of God. Because, as the film chillingly states, how can you say no to God, right? A monumental and harrowing tale of perseverance, pulling what is concealed in the dark out to light. Spotlight serves as a reminder that while it requires grit and audacity to unveil heavy truths, it is necessary work for the sake of justice and freedom. Spotlight is now on Netflix, but is leaving the platform on April 30th.
That was CHUO's Bushra Benhamed. This week marks 107 years since the Battle of Vimy Ridge. Many Canadians reflected on the significant battle that began on April 9th, 1917. It was a rainy Easter morning at 5:30 a.m. when all four Canadian divisions in northern France attacked at Vimy Ridge. Over 15,000 Canadian infantry overran the Germans through sleet, mud, and shellfire. They seized the heavily fortified 7-kilometer ridge, earning a reputation as formidable and effective troops. Previous attempts from the French military had failed, with over 100,000 casualties. Soldiers from all across Canada were at the battle, and over 10,000 would be killed or wounded. The Vimy Foundation writes that April 9, 1917 is still the bloodiest day in Canadian military history. 107 years later, folks are remembering the countless acts of sacrifice that came from this battle. On Tuesday, Prime Minister Justin Trudeau issued a statement saying Canada's success at Vimy Ridge marked one of the First World War's most memorable victories. But victory came at a heavy cost. Over 3,500 are said to have been killed at Vimy. Governor General Mary Simon is encouraging Canadians to reflect on the significance of this day and the stories of the soldiers who fought in battle. In a statement issued on Tuesday, she writes, quote, "Learn the stories of the Indigenous soldiers who fought at Vimy, such as those who served with the 107th Timberwolf Battalion, or the story of Private Robert Gilbert and other Black Canadians who fought at Vimy Ridge," end quote. Among these Black soldiers, she also points to Ethelbert, or Curly, Christian. He served with the 78th Canadian Infantry Battalion, the Winnipeg Grenadiers, during the Battle of Vimy Ridge. He was assigned to deliver supplies to the frontline trenches when heavy artillery fire buried him in a trench under dirt and debris. He was trapped there for 2 days with his limbs crushed. When Canadian troops found him, he was barely alive, and his stretcher bearers were killed by enemy fire in the effort to bring him to safety. Military records show that doctors decided to amputate his four limbs on account of gangrene. This procedure was unheard of at the time and incredibly risky. Curly Christian became the first and only person to survive a quadruple amputation during the First World War. He received artificial limbs afterwards and became an inspiration for veterans and amputees across the country. With his wife and the support of his medical team, he helped lay the foundation for what would later become a Canadian Forces Financial and Social Assistance Program for Disabled Veterans, which is still offered today. In 1922, a grateful French government granted Vimy Ridge and the land around it to Canada. Hill 145 is the highest and most significant feature of the ridge, and now the Canadian National Vimy Memorial sits atop it. The gleaming white marble sculpture features two pylons that represent Canada and France. They rise 27 meters above the base of the monument, over a now quiet countryside. The names of all 11,285 Canadian soldiers listed as missing or presumed dead in France during the World War are inscribed on the monument. This iconic memorial was designed by Toronto-born sculptor Walter Seymour Allward. He's also got a statue of Robert Baldwin and Louis-Hippolyte Lafontaine on Parliament Hill in Ottawa. When the Canadian National Vimy Memorial was unveiled in 1936, Curly Christian was among many of the veterans and amputees who attended. And calling all Ottawa School of Art members, Monday is your last chance to submit artwork for the Centre's Portrait Contest. A group of finalists will be selected by a 3-person jury. Their decision for a winner will be made by Friday, April 26th. The winner for the contest will get a $5,000 commission to create a portrait of Canadian astronaut and engineer, Colonel Chris Hadfield, who was the very first Canadian to command the International Space Station. Those looking to submit a portrait can use any medium taught by the Ottawa School of Art and must pay an entry fee of $20. Submissions can be emailed to portrait-contest@artottawa.ca. And that's it for this week's episode of The Mosaic. Thanks so much for tuning in. Music for The Mosaic is by Helizna. To listen to this episode and previous ones, go to chuo.fm/podcasts. If you're interested in joining our news team, email news@chuo.fm. We'll see you next week, Thursday at 1 p.m.